Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Rhoda Berenson, mother of Lori Berenson, who talks about the recent decision by Peru's top military court setting aside her daughter's life sentence for treason imposed almost 5 years ago and ordering a new trial in civilian court. Robin Kirk with Human Rights Watch, who criticizes President Clinton's decision to waive human rights requirements attached to a $1.3 billion U.S. aid package bound for the nation of Colombia, and Green Party vice presidential candidate Winona LaDuke, who discusses her and Ralph Nader's second run for the White House. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Miami-based Cuban-American National Foundation has recently bought ads denouncing Republican Representative George Nethercutt and others it says are supporting the communist regime of Cuban President Fidel Castro. The CANF, which is militantly anti-Castro, says it's prepared to spend tens of thousands of dollars to campaign against those who support the partial lifting of the 40-year-old U.S. trade embargo against Cuba. The ads are being distributed through television, newspapers, and radio in Nethercutt's home state of Washington. Nethercutt represents a district which is predominantly farmland and says the ongoing U.S. policy against Cuba has been ineffective. The low-cost sale of wheat and other food items to Cuba, Nethercutt told Reuters, would help both U.S. farmers and the Cuban people. The foundation, which critics charge has heavily influenced U.S. policy toward Cuba, believes that food and medicine should only be supplied to the Cuban people by way of third-party charitable donations and not through direct sales. Last month, congressional Republicans threw out a proposal to ease the embargo, but promised a vote on the issue after the August recess. The move to lift the ban on food and medicine sales to Cuba comes at a time when the U.S. is advocating open trade with countries like Communist China and North Vietnam. The news magazine In These Times reports that hardline American anti-abortion activists are traveling to Ireland to challenge recent advances in reproductive rights. Ireland and Northern Ireland are the only places in Europe where abortion services are prohibited, but over 5,000 women travel to England each year at their own expense for the procedures. In a move praised by Irish pro-choice activists, the Irish government is taking a look at a study of the medical, legal, and social implications surrounding abortions. For the moment, Irish pro-choicers are offering non-directive counseling, in essence informing patients about abortion services in England. In March 1999, the American anti-abortion group, the Christian Defense Coalition, joined with a smaller Irish group, Youth Defense, in blockading a family health clinic in Dublin for 5 hours. Anti-abortion activists sprayed graffiti on the office walls, and a few days later wanted posters with a photo of Tony O'Brien, head of the Irish Family Planning Association, were plastered throughout Dublin. The American activists were in charge of the militant action, says O'Brien. This just wasn't a protest. It was a training, an effort to directly export some of their tactics. Further, the clinic blockade denied many women vital health services. To deny someone a pap smear because you are supposedly defending life is really shoddy, O'Brien concluded. In the mid-1990s, the London-based Marine Stewardship Council was launched as a joint project of the World Wildlife Fund and Unilever, a multinational food corporation, to promote sustainable fishing practices. The idea was to create an eco-label called Fish Forever, to alert consumers in industrialized nations that the fish they are buying was caught in an environmentally sustainable manner. Despite its lofty aims, the Marine Stewardship Council has run into a lot of criticism in Asia and developing nations. Most poor fishing villages are feeling the pressure in recent years by food giants like Unilever, and to abandon traditional fishing practices in favor of high-tech approaches that are destructive to the ecosystem. In addition, global development institutions have funded practices like trawling the sea bottom that have depleted fishing stocks. According to the New Internationalist magazine, advocates of small fishermen in developing countries feel fair trade is a real alternative to the corporate-backed eco-label campaign. But for fair trade to work, a fair and equal relationship must be struck between consumers in Western countries and small fishing communities in Asia and elsewhere. One such project was started between the South Indian Federation of Fishermen Societies, a group of fishing cooperatives, and several German civic groups. Supporters hope similar projects will be adopted by other consumer groups to create direct links with fishing communities in order to uplift living standards in the developing world. In effect, sustainable fishing must be transformed into a larger fair trade enterprise through partnerships between the North and South. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon and your reporter, Denise Manzari.
On Monday, August 28th, Peru's top military court announced it would void the life sentence imposed on Lori Berenson almost 5 years ago and grant her a new trial in civilian courts. A native of New York, Berenson was charged with treason before a hooded military tribunal in January 1996. The Supreme Military Justice Commission offered no reason for the decision, as it contradicted President Alberto Fujimori's past statements that Berenson would remain in prison for life for her terrorist activities. She was accused of helping the Tupac Amaru revolutionary movement plan an attack on Peru's Congress. Lori's parents, Mark and Rhoda Berenson, have fought diligently for their daughter's release and have maintained their daughter's innocence. They travel frequently to visit their daughter, but are allowed only an hour's visit with no physical contact. Berenson was jailed for 3 years in Yanamayu, a maximum security prison with no heat or hot water, 12,700 feet high in the Andes. After developing several health problems, including intermittent blindness in one eye, Ms. Berenson was moved to the Socabaya prison at a lower altitude of 7,000 feet. Although hopeful, the Berensons are skeptical about the openness and fairness of this new trial, given Peru's history regarding cases of terrorism in civilian courts. Between the Lines, Denise Manzari spoke with Lori Berenson's mother, Rhoda.
The immediate reaction was a big up and a fall down. The big up is that it's fantastic that the Peruvian government has finally admitted that it made a mistake, which is what it did, in, you know, reversing that decision that Lori was never a leader of a military, a revolutionary group or whatever it is they accused her of, and therefore the military tribunal has no right to have heard her case. On the downside, we've heard that they're expecting to bring civilian court, bring her case into the civilian court, which, as far as we know, there's no evidence whatsoever that Lori did anything wrong, and to have her go through another kind of hokey process as a mother, it's very, very distressing to me, and we hope that somewhere in between the two processes, Peru will see the light and send her home.
Do you feel that there is a possibility of even that being voided and having her be set free without a trial?
Well, there's always that possibility. We believe that if the civilian courts looked, there's nothing to find, and would say, hey, there's nothing to find, there's no case here, and send her home. We are concerned that this is a country where the judicial branch is manipulated by the executive branch, particularly in cases related to terrorism, that there is no due process or openness or fairness as would be defined by international standards.
What do you attribute this then to, the fact that this even happened at this time?
Well, actually, the process for this began before last December. Last December, Lori filed a petition with the military court system saying, there's now new evidence that shows that I was absolutely not a leader of this group, the MRTA. Then we waited for the result, and the result came today. Now, it may have been politically an advantageous time for this result. That's a possibility. It's after the latest Peruvian election. It's at a time when the Organization of American States has been extremely critical of the Peruvian justice system, and they may want to make Lori an example.
There was actually a petition, I think, that you filed, is that correct, that was denied in July of 97 for a retrial.
Right. Lori had filed such a request actually in March of 96, and the decision came down in July of 97 to say that no, we agree with our previous decision.
What about Rhoda Berenson, the Clinton administration? We've discussed this in the past, and you've said that you haven't gotten really any results or action requested by the Clinton administration to set Lori free. Did they take any part in this?
Since that time, we've come to believe that certainly the Clintons themselves, both the president and the first lady, have taken time to express to us their concern for Lori's well-being. And, of course, like everyone else, they were appalled by the lack of due process in her initial case, and a desire to see some kind of just and expeditious solution. So it's not just Rhoda and my husband Mark Berenson who are saying, release Lori Berenson. It's a majority of the U.S. Congress. And President Clinton knows that, and I think the Peruvian government knows that. We just have to make them shout that a little louder.
Have you gotten a chance to speak with Lori?
No, well, there's absolutely no way to communicate with Lori except when we visit her. And Mark was there 10 days ago. I can go 10 days from now, but there's no telephone contact at all. We do know that a consular officer did tell Lori. She was very surprised. I mean, she had knew this was on file for a while, but still having it on file and having it acted upon are two different things.
She still remains 7,000 feet high in the Sacobaya prison in Peru. Will she have to remain there?
We don't know what the next procedure will be. It's possible that there'll be proceedings or legal issues in Lima and that the government will move her to a prison in Lima. It's possible that they will leave her where she is and the legal apparatus will move to the city of Arequipa.
You mentioned a downside to this, and that is you don't know when or if this trial will really happen.
I think the downside is if this trial happens, because we have no confidence, let me put it that way, that in any trial that's given to Lori Berenson in Peru doesn't have the ending scripted before the trial starts.
That was Rhoda Berenson. For more information about Lori Berenson's case, you can visit her supporters' website at www.freelori.org. When Congress approved a $1.3 billion military and economic aid package for the nation of Colombia in July, lawmakers attached specific human rights conditions to curb the well-documented abuses by the military. But during a required consultation with the State Department in August, human rights groups unanimously opposed certifying Colombian compliance with these conditions. President Clinton, who was preparing to travel to Colombia on August 30th, signed a national security waiver a week before his departure, freeing up U.S. funds despite Bogota's failure to meet minimal human rights conditions. The aid package includes helicopters, funds for drug crop eradication, and training by U.S. military advisors. The assistance, as framed by the White House, will help Colombia more effectively fight the drug war, interdicting supplies of cocaine and heroin destined for America. But critics warn that the U.S. position ignores the danger of becoming entangled in Colombia's decades-long civil war that pits two well-armed rebel groups against an army and paramilitary units accused of corruption and gross human rights abuses. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robin Kirk, a researcher with Human Rights Watch, who criticizes the Clinton administration's decision to waive human rights requirements attached to the U.S. Colombia aid package.
When Clinton decided to sign this waiver, what he essentially said was, we know that Colombia can't meet these human rights conditions, they can't enforce their law and control the military, but we're going to give them the aid anyway because of it, this being in the national security interest of the United States. But again, the conditions were essentially saying to the Colombians, enforce your law, control the military, use the laws that are on the books to prosecute officers who are accused of committing these violations, to go after paramilitary groups and dismantle them in the field. And Clinton's waiver essentially says that's impossible and this will continue on, and the United States will be funding the Colombian military despite the fact that we know that this relationship continues to exist between the Colombian military and the paramilitary groups.
Now, Human Rights Watch and other representatives of human rights organizations consulted with the State Department, which is mandated by law, about Colombia's human rights situation. And as I understand it, all the groups opposed human rights certification, which led to President Clinton's waiver of the human rights requirement.
Right. It's really quite amazing and heartening in some ways that a broad range of human rights groups, of aid groups, of groups that are interested in fortifying democracy, really groups from a broad range of the spectrum of non-governmental organizations, came together on this and in a unified way opposed the certification, opposed the waiver, and have been strongly critical of this strategy, of this idea that you're going to be able to solve the situation in Colombia by pouring more money into the war machine.
Specifically, what are some of the abuses that are occurring in Colombia that have been documented by your organization and others that have led you all to oppose human rights certification?
Well, one kind of abuse is something that happened just 2 weeks ago on August 15th. The Colombian army was on patrol and started shooting some rustling in the bushes, and it turned out to be an elementary school field trip. The soldiers killed 6 children between the ages of 5 and 7. This is not an unusual occurrence. The Colombian military routinely shoots first and asks questions later. In many ways, the Colombian army considers civilians among the targets. This is an extreme case, but it is not at all an unusual case where soldiers will shoot and then later find out that they shot the wrong people. That's one kind of case. Another kind of case is where the military will work with the groups that we call paramilitaries. They're essentially groups of civilians, many wealthy or backed by wealthy financiers, landowners, ranchers, and even drug traffickers. And they have organized as an army to fight the guerrillas. The Colombian military formed these groups in the 1980s. They were outlawed in 1989 because of their record of abuses. But the Colombian government never really dismantled these paramilitary groups and has allowed the military to set up a kind of a de facto relationship with them. The Colombian military uses paramilitaries as essentially their offensive force in the field. The Colombian military is a very sedentary military. It stays in one place. It doesn't really mount a lot of offensive actions. It waits for the paramilitaries to go in and kind of try to engage the guerrillas, or what often occurs, the paramilitaries simply target civilians who they believe or even just suspect are supporting Marxist guerrillas, and then will execute the civilians as a message to the people who live in a region to either support the paramilitaries or leave.
Robin, I wanted to ask you to respond to something the White House says. The White House says that President Andres Pastrana of Colombia and the military are working hard to make progress on human rights issues. The fact that the military in some ways is out of control in Colombia speaks to the need for training by U.S. soldiers and U.S. leadership and guidance in this.
Before you can really talk about any kind of training being effective is accountability, is showing the officers who pay for abuses, who order abuses, who contract out with these paramilitaries to commit atrocities, they need to go to jail, and they need to learn that this is going to kill their careers. To the contrary, right now in Colombia, these officers who sp- sponsor atrocities are rewarded. I can mention just one case, which was recently on the cover of the New York Times newspaper. It was a case of a massacre in February of over 70 people. The officer in charge of this region is well known to human rights groups because he has been patronizing and supporting paramilitary groups since the early 1990s. After the massacre this year, he was promoted from colonel to general, in other words, rewarded for his record in the field. So in essence, the United States is giving money to a military that still considers atrocities potentially, you know, career points for advancement. And I think, you know, no training is ever going to address that issue. To mix a metaphor here, the real meat of the problem is in the fact that these people are still rewarded for what they do.
That was Robin Kirk with Human Rights Watch. Contact Human Rights Watch by calling area code 202-612-4321 or visit their website at www.hrw.org. Ralph Nader, America's best-known consumer advocate and citizen activist, is running for president on the Green Party ticket again this year. As in 1996, Nader selected Winona LaDuc as his vice presidential running mate. LaDuc, a Harvard University-educated economist, author, and activist, lives on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She serves as the co-chair of the Indigenous Women's Network and is program director at the Honor the Earth Fund. After their 1996 effort, which garnered only 1% of the vote, this year Nader and LaDuc are both energetically campaigning around the country and working hard to appear on the ballot in at least 45 states. Recent public opinion polls give the Green Party ticket 5 to 10% support, with even higher percentages in some key states like California and Oregon. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Winona LaDuc about the goals of her campaign and the concern expressed by some Democrats that the Green Party ticket could play the role of spoiler, giving Republican George W. Bush a victory in November.
I think that Al Gore and George Bush Jr. are spoilers. I think they're spoiling our democracy. I think that each generation of candidates, it gets worse and worse, the choices in this country, and that the average person, whether they're an American worker who's making on par what they were during the Nixon administration, adjusted for inflation, or a mother or a kid trying to go to school in a dilapidated school, one of the 47 or so million Americans with no health care, I think that all of those people need some justice. I think that we need candidates who are accountable to us. And I think that I'm tired of being told that Ralph and I are spoilers when Ralph is someone who's got immense integrity. And casting a vote for Ralph is not going to the polls and voting for the lesser of two evils. Because in the end, if you go to the polls and vote for the lesser of two evils, you still end up with evil. Instead, it's voting for what we want to see in America.
Winona, one of the central questions on the spoiler issue, and I'll get off of that in a moment, but I think one important thing that comes up in my own conversations with people about how they're going to vote this year, they confront the question of a woman's right to choose, choice in the Supreme Court. People who want to preserve a woman's right to choose are very fearful of what a George W. Bush regime in Washington would bring that particular set of rights. How do you respond to that concern, which is certainly out there?
It is a shame that every 4 years, a bunch of male candidates stand up and talk about women's right to choice. And that is the only thing they talk about in terms of women. They don't address the issues of quality of life for the millions of women in this country that are at or below the poverty level, or the 20 million American children that are in poverty and hungry, or the insidious violence of the contamination that's causing epidemic levels of breast cancer and uterine cancer and ovarian cancer. So I resent that that's how they talk about women, and that's all they choose to talk about is women's issues. Where are these guys out to bat on every other issue? Second thing I say is that I don't believe that George W. Bush would be stupid enough to take away women's rights to choose. But if you look, in fact, at the most conservative, many of the most conservative judges that have been appointed, many of those have been also appointed by Democratic administrations.
Winona, you mentioned ballot access in the struggle that you and other third parties have had to go through to get on the ballot to give voters a choice when it comes to selecting their candidates. We also have the debates coming up, and the Democrat and Republican appointed members of a debate commission want to exclude you and other third parties unless you have a threshold of 15% support out there in the polls. Tell us about citizens' roles at this point in making their voice heard on this issue of ballot access and the debates.
Today in USA Today, there was a letter to the editor saying, let Ralph debate. There are three letters to the editor, and those letters all said, let Ralph debate. And they pointed to this instance in the state that I live in, Minnesota. Jesse Ventura is today the governor of Minnesota, and Jesse Ventura was at 10% in the polls and would not have been allowed under the Federal Debate Commission rules to participate in the debates. Yet Jesse Ventura went into the state gubernatorial debates and won. He won with 37% of the vote, and his votes also coincided with the single largest voter turnout in gubernatorial election history in the state of Minnesota. People voted for Jesse Ventura because he was different. He had something else to say. He spoke to them. And I believe that Ralph, if he is allowed into those debates, will speak to the American people in a way that none of those other candidates will. And I believe that if Ralph goes into those debates, people will vote for him. That is what the Democrats and the Republicans are afraid of. They saw what happened with Ross Perot, the increase in percentage points in the polls and his votes when he was in the presidential debates. And that's why we're being excluded. But yet this is a debate commission, and it should not be. It's supposed to be a nonpartisan. And a nonpartisan debate commission should allow the other parties in. We are demonstrating a commitment and a high rankings in the polls. We should be allowed in there to debate. Not only is it the right thing to do, but I'm going to tell you what, it's going to make it way more interesting if Ralph's allowed into those debates. And, of course, I'm allowed to debate Dick Cheney. Write to the debate commission, lobby your politicians, write letters to the editor, get your op-ed pieces with your editorial board. That's just saying to people, that doesn't mean they got to vote for us. That just means give us a chance to have a dialogue.
That was Green Party vice presidential candidate Winona LaDuke. To contact the Green Party, call area code 202-265-4000 or visit their website at www.votenader.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced by WPKN Radio's Public Affairs and News Departments. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a cassette copy of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Archibald Currie.